This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by MintSim, the best way to get cheap 4G LTE data in the U.S. Use the offer code ACFREESHIP for free shipping anywhere in the U.S. on your first MintSim purchase. Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast for the week of May 26, 2017. My name is Daniel Bader, and we got a threefer for you this week, all the way from Seattle, Washington. Andrew Martinick, how are you, man?
I'm doing just fine, all the way over there. You make it
Me it is. I guess it's all relative.
You make it sound like I'm thousands of miles away from you, which I am.
You kind of are. And a short jaunt from Seattle, in the beautiful state of California. Florence Ion, welcome back. We missed you last week.
Hello. Yeah, last week was crazy. My gosh.
Where were we last week, Flo?
We were in Mountain View at Google I.O. And let me tell you guys, I still need to clean my shoes off from all that dust.
Yeah, I'm sure Andrew's trying to clean FYI. His lungs still.
Yeah, I'm trying to clean my sinuses out, guys.
Oh my gosh, yes. At the end of last week, my throat and my nasal passage, they were hurting. I felt like I just had this perpetual layer of dust just kind of like in my trachea.
You know, I was saying, I'm not sure which podcast it was on, but I was saying it was nice how much more infrastructure they built out for I.O. this year with a lot more cover and the water trucks everywhere and everything. But they can't stop the nature from just permeating everything.
Oh my gosh. And then after you guys left, I left too and I went to go to my car because I drove myself that day and I lost my car in the parking lot. It took me a really long time to find it. So
what?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Well, no. I was in the overflow lot and I just thought it was a funny way to end I.O. of me like pushing the panic button on my key trying to find my car in a sea of cars like all covered in dust. It was fun.
Oh, well, there are so many stories like that from the Shoreline Amphitheater. It's just such a sprawling mess. I mean, we didn't even talk about the fire incident that forced us all out of the press area because we still don't know exactly what happened, but apparently somebody was burned quite severely, I heard.
It was like the catering area was kind of near the press area.
Yeah.
Something happened.
The person who was injured is doing well.
I hope so too. I hope it was just a surface injury and although the emotional scarring.
A surface injury and not a pixel injury?
Whoa.
It's okay. That was better than where I was going.
Yeah, I'm channeling Phil Nickenson here. Okay, so let's do some follow-up. Let's talk a little bit about I.O. We didn't have you on the show last week, Flo, because you were gallivanting around Mountain View. So obviously, you know, you actually were in a pretty interesting position. You got a chance to talk to some developers on the ground. You went around and interviewed them for our Instagram Stories channel. You wrote up a little thing on it. And I think the big takeaway for me was that I'm like blanking on the name here all of a sudden. The new language, Kotlin.
Yes, Kotlin.
Was the most interesting part of the show. And Jerry wrote up a big thing about why it's important. But from your impression, why were the developers, without any major updates, any major product announcements, so excited about I.O. this year?
Because it's going to make developing easier for them. I mean, that's essentially how it was explained to me, because I'm not a developer, but anytime I ask somebody about Kotlin, they said, oh God, I'm so excited. This is going to make my life so much easier. And it's kind of the thing that's inspiring me to maybe try out this programming thing as a hobby, just because everybody sort of sold me on it last week just by talking about how great it was. I heard nothing negative about it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I find super interesting is, you know, Apple made some big waves a few years ago with Swift.
That's true.
How it introduced Swift as an alternative to Objective-C. And the one major takeaway I heard from developers, from iOS developers, was that Swift is very it's much simpler and much more straightforward with a lot less overhead. And I think Kotlin is to Objective-C, or is to Java rather, what Swift is to Objective-C. It just, it takes away a lot of the overhead from developers and will allow them to write considerably less code with the same results.
I thought Jerry actually explained it really well when we were, it was like our second to last night, and we were just voraciously eating Mexican food. And he was saying that, yes, which by the way is a chain I had no idea about. Jerry was explaining that Kotlin is, it's like a language where you can read exactly what the code is doing. Kind of like, because I had asked him, I was like, so the person like me who say dabbled, you know, in HTML in the past, and that was kind of like my only, you know, quote unquote programming experience. Like, how would you explain that to a person like me? And he said, well, it's, you know, HTML, you're essentially, when you read it, you kind of know what it's doing. And that's the same concept with Kotlin, is that it takes that messy JavaScript and it makes it into a language that you can just read like a full sentence.
Right. Andrew, you know, we were obviously in the thick of it, and, you know, we talked about this last week, but what, like, what's your TLDR now that it's been a week later of Google I/O? What was the biggest takeaway for you from the show?
Aside from developers getting super, super, super excited about Kotlin, which we should be excited about because it should make, it should streamline the app development, app update process. I think it's all about Google, you know, flexing its server muscle basically and saying, we have this massive computing backend, and it can manifest itself in so many different ways across pretty much everything that Google's doing. There's no standalone product that just does one thing and doesn't have a massive Google backend to it. We're just seeing these announcements of these front ends to basically just Google server infrastructure.
Right. Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's a good way to put it. Every part of the of the show was permeated by this idea of adding AI, of integrating Assistant, of eventually putting Lens in there. And we've already seen some features that were announced at I/O start rolling out. Yesterday, I believe, Google started asking you on Google Photos to verify yourself.
Oh, yeah.
On the channel so that you can, because right now, if you search for faces on Google Photos, obviously you are the first person in your filter, usually because you have the most photos of yourself in the database. But Google Photos doesn't necessarily know that you are you. Now it will, and now it'll be able to place you in relation to the other people in your life. So this'll help them give suggested sharing once that rolls out as well. So we have archiving as well that rolled out to Google Photos in the last week, which is Flo, is that a big deal? I don't really see the point of it. It doesn't make sense to me, but I guess people don't necessarily want to see every photo in their feed.
Yeah, and I think about the situation, like, ugh, my parents will like grab my phone to look at my pictures. I'm like, please don't go through my stuff, but anyway, that's a battle I'm still fighting. But it's kind of nice to be able to have the ability to curate like what shows up at least on, you know, in the last few reels of photos that you've taken. I mean, I appreciate it. I appreciate kind of like curating that. I think it also has to do with the fact that like Google wants you to take the Photos app and sort of like show it to other people. You know what I mean? So it's like giving you more incentive to use the app as your virtual photo album.
Interesting.
And I would say that it's also a situation of you want to have that main feed. You know, they want to encourage people to be able to just scroll through that and kind of, you know, have a good experience. Whereas, I mean, I'm super OCD, and like I, even though I know that I have unlimited storage, I delete stuff pretty regularly because I want it to look nice and clean as I scroll through. But some people want to use Google Photos as this dumpster, or I, you know, the same way they use, you know, old shoe boxes full of photos back in the day. They don't want to delete anything, but they don't want everything up, you know, up front and center all the time. So this is a way that you can archive all that stuff, like photos of receipts and business cards and screenshots and all the stuff you want to have there, but you know, it doesn't belong in an album and you don't want it to, you know, be able to see it as you scroll through. So you got to give that place somewhere to live that you know it's going to be backed up, but you don't really care to reference it all that often.
Yeah.
Right. I guess for me, the term archive, the association I have is through Gmail, where sure. if something is archived, I don't want it anymore. You know, I don't necessarily want to delete it, but I still don't really ever want to see it again. Whereas things like receipts and other, you know, extraneous photos, random poor photos that I've taken, I generally just want to delete. I want to delete the bad photos, and I want to not archive the receipts. I want Google to do a better job classifying them. You know, so for example,
yeah,
I would love a filter. I would love something that would allow me. You know, Google knows that when there's a person in my feed or in my photo,
so
give me
know
the
if
option
it's a
to filter just the non, you know, the inanimate objects or the people or, you know, a combination of that. I don't know. I just don't know if the archive, that notion of archiving emails follows suit to photos.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it should use machine learning to know and say, this is a receipt, we're going to file it away to a work folder in Google Photos.
But I don't know, maybe I'm just nitpicking.
No, I think it's fair.
People want, I mean, the whole idea of Google Photos is that these things happen automatically and you don't have to, I mean, we've been trained by the way that Photos works in the last year that albums get created automatically and they do all these stylized photos and everything. And I think they could go a bit further and say, you know, in that assistant tab, how would you like to, you know, can we group together all your screenshots into one place? Can we group together all your receipts into one place? And maybe that would encourage people, you know, to do that. And even if it gets, you know, 90% of them and you have to add a couple more, that's way better than having them just sit in the feed all the time. I mean, I know the Google Photos search is so good that I don't find myself making that many albums because I can just search by city or date range or monument or you know, whatever and get those photos pretty well. But, you know, if they could nudge people toward making more albums, that would be super helpful.
I mean, that's another thing too, is we've become so accustomed to searching instead of archiving, instead of actually categorizing or planning. You know, and I use something, I use Android Central Search as an example. Our Insight search is not great. Instead, and we're working on it, it'll eventually become great, but for now it is not. So instead, I'm sure you are similar to me, Andrew and Flo, you search our own articles on
for
Google.
Everything. I even search
so
for apps
faster.
On my phone. That's even how I find apps on the phone. I just search for it and have them come
exactly.
up.
Exactly. You search for things. I mean, search has become the fastest. It's almost like a launcher in and of itself.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting that with Google Photos, I'm like you, Andrew. I have no albums unless they're automatically created for me by Google.
And then you add stuff to it because you're like, oh, thank you for doing that job that I didn't want to do. Now that you've curated some stuff for me, you know, I can take the 15 minutes after I viewed this to maybe add or remove a couple things. And then bam, you've got an album you can share with your friends and fam.
But so many of them are like, Wednesday in Seattle. Or
and then and it's like, oh, because I happened to take 30 photos this day when I normally take 10.
But then in three
it thinks
years,
that it was like a trip.
In 3 years, you'll look back on that and go, oh, I remember that work trip I took. And then I saw Andrew and we got that, you know, steak or whatever you guys would share.
Sure.
If it's with Andrew, it's most likely a steak, let's be honest.
That's true. Yeah. But I think that if they could just continue to refine that automatic creation, they wouldn't necessarily have this issue of your main photo feed just being overrun with lots and lots of, you know, duplicates and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't see why they, you know, now that they have this archive function, they couldn't say, I see you took 30 photos of basically the same thing. Would you like to keep this one and just archive the other 29? You can come back to them later, but that way when you scroll through Google Photos, you're not going to see every, you know, these 30 photos in a row, you know, stuff like that could easily be done, it seems.
Do you think that this is, do you think this is teaching Google Photos what to archive, this little feature?
Yeah, that's a good point. It may just be providing Google with so much data that they could then give you proactive ideas on what to archive. Like,
somebody's got to do some of the work. Yeah.
You've never touched this photo. You've never looked at the photos you took on this day. Would you like to archive them? Or, you know, more likely what will happen is, hey, it looks like you took a bunch of receipts. Would you like to archive them?
Yeah.
Because for me, I take all my receipts from, you know, just for my own reference, but I never want to look at them unless I'm invoicing something or, you know, otherwise I do that once and that's it.
Ah, that steak dinner that I spent my bonus on.
And I'm looking through my photos gallery or my albums gallery now. I don't know if you're in the same situation, but when Google Photos replaced Picasa, Picasa, I actually use quite a lot, and I made my own albums on there. So,
I was never a Picasa person.
Yeah, I was a Flickr gal. But there's this
transition now where I have from like 2007 up until, when is it, 2013 or so, when Picasa went away, or at least I stopped using it very often. I have these very tightly curated albums. For example, I have an unboxing gallery of the Galaxy Nexus that I took on the 8th of December, 2011. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that I would love for Google to make it easier for us to do. And I'm sure it's getting there, but it's not quite there yet.
Soon.
Oh man, it is cool looking at the photos though. Just to see what you did like 2 years ago. That's why Time Hop, I think, is such a, I love it. You know, if you haven't watched Mr. Mobile's what apps I use video from a couple days ago now, he uses Time Hop, and that reminded me, oh yeah, I should sign up for that again.
Although I left my Twitter unchecked on that, by the way, because I kept it kept aggregating all the replies. Like, I don't really want to read the replies to people that I wrote 7 years ago.
Yeah, that's fair.
Much.
And I wasn't as charming and intelligent as I, you know, 7 years ago as I am now, which is BS.
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, right. adulting is hard. All right, Google I/O, it's all done. But Andrew, you were using a phone during I/O nobody else had, and everybody else wanted a piece of. This was so funny. So many people were like, "Can I?"
Could have lifted so many fingerprints off this phone.
Ooh. Yeah, you could have solved a murder with the number of fingerprints that were on that phone. So we're talking about the HTC U11. Obviously, that got it's coming out in early June, but you got an unlocked Taiwanese model. You put out the review early today, today being Friday, May 26th. You like it. You like it a lot. And I'm super excited to hear your expansive thoughts on it.
You know, I like it way more than I thought I was going to, just because I was so frustrated with the U Ultra. And this is, you know, ostensibly just the smaller version of the U Ultra. And that's kind of the weird thing. I mean, the U Ultra and U Play didn't make any sort of splash. This is also a U series phone at the same time as being a successor to the HTC 10. So I almost feel like for anybody that was following along with the original U phones, HTC would have been better off just calling this the HTC 11 and kind of being like, okay, we tried that U thing a couple months ago and that really didn't work out, but they're sticking with it. And it's mostly because the hardware is visually very similar. I will say that it's not the exact same as the U Ultra, thankfully. It's actually a normal sized phone at 5.5 inches, but it has this amazing glass back that is, I mean, I think everybody says, oh, you know, most phones have glass backs nowadays, but this is completely different. If you look at an LG G6 or a Galaxy S8, it's just a piece of clear glass with some paint on the inside, a coating on the inside, and that's where it looks like glass. The color is inside the glass. So they're making panes of glass that have the color embedded in it. It's not clear in any way. You can't scratch it off. And that's why they get this crazy shifting color thing where I was sharing some photos and you can see them in my review that I have the silver one, but it doesn't actually look silver. It can look, you know, blue or green or purple or white or whatever. It takes in the colors that are around it and gives you this really, really interesting look. And it's just unique, and it's something you expect from HTC. They have like some of the most iconic smartphone designs. You know, I think it's easy to look at a phone from 5 years ago and say that was an HTC phone. And I think this is going to be another one of those, you know, levels of hardware. But the reason why I really like it is they're not doing all this stuff that LG and Samsung and Huawei do where they just throw a million features at you. I mean, you can call what they're doing in Sense boring, and I think that I might have even used the word boring either in my video review or my written review, but I would prefer this, which is much closer to Android 7.1 that you'd find on a Pixel, to something where they try a whole bunch of features and they don't really work. So I think I noted in my review that I just put I installed Google Keyboard on this, and that was it. I didn't have to change anything. I didn't have to go turn off or disable a bunch of apps. I didn't have to do any of that. It's refreshing that is like a good thing. The fact that they didn't do something is good, but
they didn't duplicate. That's the thing, is that there's no duplication.
Right. And I think this is something that Moto does pretty well as well, is they don't have a million different apps and features that do the exact same thing that, you know, what's preloaded in Android. And HTC doesn't duplicate on Google's apps. So like Google Photos is your default gallery app. And sure, they change the dialer and the clock, but you know, the calculator is the same, and Google Calendar is here as the default calendar, and you know, things like that. You get your app drawer isn't just filled up with a million different things.
Yeah. I mean, I remember 2 years ago, 3 years ago with the HTC One M9. That was 2 years ago. Yeah. And I talked to an executive at the time about this, and they were like, he was like, we're just tired of investing money in apps that people don't use and don't care about when Google makes better versions. When we have a reason to make an app, we will continue to do so. So for example, he said that the HTC email app at the time was essential because it supported Microsoft
Exchange.
Now yep. Now Gmail supports Exchange, but back then it didn't. But these are things that, you know, HTC is basically just trying to save money and not annoy, you know, the core Android base.
And so,
I think it works.
Well, it really works because it's not just the apps, it's the rest of the interface too. HTC doesn't go out of their way to change things unnecessarily. You pull down the notification shade, it looks the exact same as a Pixel on N. You open the settings. Yes, they've changed a couple of icons, but it's the same white, gray, and like, you know, teal, seafoam green kind of color throughout. They added a couple extra settings panes, you know, for their boom sound and USonic and stuff like that. We can talk about that in a minute, but they didn't change anything that, you know, just for the sake of keeping a brand together or anything like that. And that's refreshing. And it comes out in the performance where it's just ridiculous how much better it performs than a Galaxy S8 or an LG G6. And I know a lot of people are going to be upset about that, but I know I talked to Daniel a little bit about this, where it's kind of this imperceptible thing with touch response that we've gone back and forth about touch response. But the touch response is just absolutely perfect, where it feels natural and scrolling feels perfect and natural, and it's consistently smooth, and you open and close apps and it never drops a frame and it never stutters, it never has an issue. And you can pick up a Galaxy S8 that has nothing on it and it feels like that, but after a week and installing 100 apps, it doesn't feel like that.
I'm having the same lag issues with the Tab S3, by the way. Sorry. I just wanted to add with the S Pen.
And so the U11 doesn't have that issue. It's still just as fast after I've been using it for a week and a half as it was the minute I took it out of the box and set it up with nothing on it. And that's something that I really don't experience all that often. And we all put up with a little bit of the slowdown because we like the features, the design or whatever, but a lot of people hold that quality in a very high position. You know, those are a lot of the people that already have a Pixel or have used Nexuses in the past because they say, I don't care about all the extra features. I just want it to be fast and smooth and simple. And like, that's where the U11 is at across the entire interface.
So I wonder how HTC manages that. And
you infer in
the review that it might be something to do with a licensing agreement.
I have a feeling that there has to be something there. They're just so far and away better. It's it's a mix of potential licensing agreements and some very obsessive software engineers. But it's just very interesting that HTC is so far ahead of everybody else in that respect, in the responsiveness.
It is. It's. I mean, I don't know how much further they're ahead than say Motorola. And Motorola has also had amazing touch response. And I don't know if it's directly correlated to the so-called simplicity or minimalism of the Android skin either, because it's not like the HTC skin is like that minimal. Still quite different from what you'd find on a Pixel. So
they've changed enough stuff that yes, it is its own thing, but you're right. I don't think that Samsung adding in an extra 5 or 10 apps is to blame for that discrepancy.
I mean, it could be the stuff that's having the stuff that's open in the background all the time on a Samsung phone.
Samsung does have Knox too, which HTC doesn't.
We talk a lot. I mean, I know Jerry's gone on about this where, you know, we've talked about the apps being kicked out of memory unnecessarily and all that kind of stuff. Each manufacturer puts different amounts of resources, locked up for certain things. Samsung made this change where they were locking the home screen and the camera into memory at all times. And people were upset because that meant that, one of their apps was closing unnecessarily. But it gave them the ability to, every time you hit the home button, you snap back to the home screen. And every time you double press the home button or now the power button, the camera opens instantly. And so those were their priorities. And, I think HTC just has a higher priority on, locking things at 60 frames per second, no matter what. And it shows.
Andrew, what about all that squeezing? What's the squeezing about? Can you talk about the squeezing? Because that's a software feature that's added, right?
It's my favorite thing ever, the squeezing. Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, and I were having some good fun about this during Google I/O. But so this is kind of an interesting thing that I likened to Moto's gestures, where you do the twist for the camera and the chop for the flashlight, and BlackBerry just having a programmable convenience key on the side. You just, instead of having a key or a twist, you just squeeze the sides of the phone, and I liked it as far as just being able to launch the camera and then launch Google Assistant, which I then changed to a screenshot for a longer squeeze. But it's not like this huge change to the way you use your phone. It's no different than, it's just another thing that you learn that this phone does. And yes, it works, but there are probably 3 or 4 different ways that you could conveniently launch these features. And I think that this is a really good proof of concept. And I think you could easily see a world in which HTC makes a phone without buttons on it at all. Mm. And you would have a series of, squeezes. I think you look at it just like Moto with the G5 did this kind of crazy swipe navigation around the on the bottom of the phone. That's just something new they're trying out, and it doesn't mean that Moto is going to just take the navigation buttons off of its phones by default. And it doesn't mean that HTC is necessarily going to do that. But I think that this is something that shows that they can do that. And sure, you can turn it off, but it's one of these things where, unlike a button, it's not there. Like, if you turn it off in the software, it just, you know, it turns off. You can't, you know, disable a button and have the button disappear. So from that perspective, I'm totally happy with it. It works as intended and you can turn it off.
Okay, yeah. I just feel like, is this something that you're going to forget about in 3 weeks or 3 days or 3 months? Like,
good question.
I think the interesting thing is, by keeping it on the camera, that's about the only reason that I actually continued to use it. If it was, which again, you can still launch the camera with a double press of the power button. So they know that you may fall back to your old habits. And I could easily see most people just forgetting it's there. That's the one downside to it being, you know, like a gesture, is you have to remember that it's there and, you know, kind of ingrain it in yourself. If it wasn't programmed to the camera, I probably would have forgotten about it as well. That's kind of the downside. But I mean, it's there if you want to use it. I don't think that HTC should be hanging its hat on this. I mean, I understand that it's a cool thing that no other phone does, but it's kind of like if BlackBerry completely surrounded its marketing around a convenience key.
That's kind of what TCL did with the Alcatel Idol 3. But the boom key. That was the first example of a key that was in the what should have been the power button's place, and it was
right. It was the pre Bixby button.
I was just going to make a Bixby reference. I was going to say. Sounds like a key that I know.
Oh, man. Well, if Jerry was here, he'd be defending it. But I like the key one. I do. I don't love it the way that the Crackberry people and Jerry do. But
well, that's all they got, all right?
Yeah, let
anyway,
him have it.
I do think that there's potential here. It's just interesting. You know, this is something that Windows Phone experimented with. I know that unreleased what was the code name of that Windows Phone? It's slipping my mind right now.
I want to say it was like a car name of some sort.
Yeah, I haven't read Windows Phone news in like 3 years.
Neither has anybody else.
I was the site editor for Windows Central for like 4 months before I took over AC, and it was interesting because like I didn't start using Windows. I was more just kind of making sure that the ship was running, you know, properly. But I read everything, mm-hmm. and I loved being completely engrossed and sort of thrown into this new culture, because it is completely new. I mean, so few of the writers on Windows Central use any Google services at all. Right, you get, you know, at least on iMore, for example, a lot
How
of the
do you,
you
live?
Know, I know that, you know, Renee, Serenity, you know, Micah, Lori, like they all use Google services on an iPhone or an iPad, right? Because Google services are generally better than the Apple equivalents. But when you're running Windows, you can go all in on Microsoft, and the services are actually really good. You know, they're so much better than they used to be. And in many ways, they're absolutely comparable to what's on Android. And the stuff that's on Android is good too. So, I find it really interesting that you can kind of go all in on it. Speaking of which, are Microsoft apps preloaded on the HTC U11, Andrew?
No. I should say on the international model, they are not.
Oh yeah, good point. Who knows what
because
the carriers?
Because that is increasingly something that Microsoft is.
They've basically
striking deals on.
Shaken down every Android manufacturer there is, including HTC.
And that seems like something that HTC would like to try to make some money off
as it should, I guess.
But no, it's just not here, unfortunately. Well, fortunately for me, because I don't use them.
What carriers will carry the HTC U11?
Sprint and don't buy it from Sprint, buy it on Locked, people.
Yeah.
I saw somebody that was complaining, well, maybe not complaining, just critiquing in the comments of the review saying, you know, I really wish this is available on carriers. And I get it from the perspective of, I think it's a really good phone, so I want more people to have access to it. And being on the shelves in the US carriers is how you, you know, get that out there. Even if people end up buying it unlocked, like that's where you can just go see phones. But if you're on Android Central commenting on a review of the U11, you're very aware that you can just buy the phone unlocked. And I make several mentions to mm-hmm. it in the review. And you can buy it unlocked with no carrier intervention at all. You can finance it over 24 months from HTC.com. You can finance it over 12 months on Amazon. It's cheaper than buying it from Sprint. You get the same, you know, full warranty. It completely supports all the major carriers. Even the unlocked one even works on Sprint and Verizon. So HTC has done just about all it can in terms of the unlocked experience. And so I get it. Like, I get that it's not available in the carrier, but you have very, if you're to the point of complaining that it's not available from a carrier, you should know that you can buy it unlocked.
The thing is, and I completely agree, but over 70% of Americans still buy their phones from a carrier. Most people would never even consider an unlocked phone.
They didn't even know the Pixel was people who were interested in the Pixel. They saw the Verizon ads and they would say to me, but I can't get it. It's only on Verizon. I'm like, no, it's unlocked. Verizon's just not going to tell you that because they want your money.
It's an uphill battle. You're
and
right,
it's not
Daniel.
A pricing thing either. In Canada, an unlocked phone is generally not available with financing. But I believe, you know, Google, HTC, Samsung, if you want to buy a phone unlocked from the manufacturer, there are equivalent, if not better, financing deals available. You just have to know where to go to get them.
Yeah, I think that the big hurdle there is the US, we had this short period in which we were separating the phone plan from the phone, and then all of a sudden we got straight back into this with buy one, get one free deals that lock you into paying over 2 years no matter what. And these leasing programs where you're locked into, you know, Galaxy Forever or, you know, T-Mobile Jump or whatever. And so now people have just gone back to being dependent on the carriers. And we skipped this. We had this like 1 year period where people were kind of super interested in unlocked. And then all of a sudden we've just, the carriers have pulled back all the control on that, even though the deals are available unlocked. I mean, I completely applaud the fact that you can just go type in HTC U11 into Amazon and just buy the phone for the same price as it is from HTC and cheaper than it is from Sprint. They just have to do a massive amount of, I guess, consumer, I don't even know.
Education.
Yeah, sure. I mean, unlocked education.
Right. And I mean, we have a responsibility there too. And we've spoken about this. I think It's partly, you know, our fault to some extent. We fall into the trap of reporting on all of the carrier deals, and we really do sort of play their games. Sure. Whenever T-Mobile launches, you know, a 2-for-1 plan, or you get the third plan, or get the third line for $30 a month when you sign up for two, like all of these things, we're like, oh, that's a great deal. But at the end of the day, you know, I think most of us use carriers as dumb pipes that provide us data, and that's pretty much it. We would never buy our phone from a carrier because, well, I mean, this is a very elite point of view. We don't usually pay for phones, or if we do, they're usually bought unlocked. But there's certainly a mindset shift that needs to take place, and it is not just for tech bloggers. It's to your advantage, listener, to look into this, not necessarily to buy a phone unlocked, but to do the math and figure out, okay, your carrier is generally going to charge you X number of dollars per month on a plan. If you buy the phone through the carrier, it'll be purchased through financing, and you'll essentially tack on the price of the phone in 24 installments or 18 installments. and you pay off the phone that way. And by the end of that period, you've paid off the phone and your monthly plan goes down by the same amount of money, right? It's pretty simple math. The difference is that they kind of get you with all these other little things, right? Especially if you bundle. So if you're on AT&T, you may have internet and, I don't know, cable television or whatever. Or I don't think AT&T offers cable television, but you may have internet. And
yeah,
or they have DirecTV.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all kind of, yeah, they have DirecTV now. So, but yeah, that's the problem is people do know how this works because they buy computers and they don't buy computers from their ISP. As much as Comcast would love to sell you a Comcast laptop. But so people know how to do this. People go to Amazon and they buy Chromebooks by the bucket load. They buy MacBooks directly from Apple. They buy Surfaces directly from Microsoft. So there's that, you know, one-to-one relationship, especially in the case of Apple and Microsoft, where most of the time are going directly to the manufacturer to buy. So it's just interesting that you know, there's such this legacy of buying from carriers for smartphones that it's stuck around so heavily to the, I think you said 70% buy from carriers in the US, right, Daniel? But this is, I agree that we could probably be doing more to separate out and explain what's going on. And I think that the big thing for us is unlocked phones have usually meant cheaper and mid-range phones, like good value phones, whereas it's not always the case. You know, you can buy the high-end phones unlocked too. Yeah,
no, that's true. Although, you know, who's going to pay $724.99 outright for a Galaxy S8 when it comes out at the end of the month?
I know. Well, and in that specific case, the people that are in the know to buy an unlocked phone have been completely, you know, broken down and set, you know, from the Galaxy S7 unlocked having update problems and all that sort of thing. You know, that hasn't that hasn't painted that particular situation properly. But I mean, the money aspect, sure, I understand that it's expensive, but you just have to be able to get past that first little hurdle to explain that it's the same price they're paying at the carrier as well. And that, you know, there are financing deals available. I don't know. I think that there has to be a little education there, but I think people get the sticker shock in the same way, or in a different way from the carriers, because the carriers, they don't face you with that. Like when you go to the T-Mobile's page and you click on Galaxy S8, they don't show you the full retail price even anymore. They show you $0 down, and that's all that matters. Or you go to Verizon and they show you $29 per month. They actually sort the phones by monthly price. And it's not even comparable to the other carriers because AT&T can give you a lower monthly price, but it's for 30 months instead of 24. So, you know, they're always going to have a little bit of an edge
there. It's
like
when you buy a packet of chips and you're like, oh, it only has 100 calories. And then the serving size is like 10 grams. And you have to work out the math between two separate brands of chips because, you know, one has a serving size of 18 grams and one has one of 10 grams or something. And there's no standard. And that's you know, an issue here is that, you know, the FCC is deregulating as much as it can. There's certainly no impetus for them to regulate the way that companies sell phones because, you know, to them, this is something that Verizon can have a competitive advantage on. If they want to sell a Galaxy S8 at $31.50 a month for 24 months with 0% APR, that's essentially the same as buying a car. I mean, that is the same language that you would hear in a car commercial.
Yeah.
Except for that, you know, the car is $50,000 and you're paying $200 a week for, you know, for the same amount of time or something.
Yeah, it just seems so crazy to me. Like I said, because we haven't had that language surrounding any other types of technology, you know, personal technology. that's the weird disconnect. I mean, we just Flo just reviewed the Dex dock for the Galaxy S8 that turns it into a computer, but we're buying that device differently than the actual computer on our desk.
One last thing while we're on this, because I'm on the Verizon webpage and I'm just finding this so fascinating. So the Moto Z Play is it's $408 on its own, right? If you buy it outright. But right now you can get it for $10 a month for 24 months, which is $240. But you only... but you actually pay $17 a month, which is the $408 price, and you get $168 bill credit at the end of 24 months, right? So
yes.
You're only paying $240 for the phone, but you're not, because you're paying $408 for the phone unless you keep it for 24 months.
Yeah.
And so T-Mobile does the exact same thing. Well, most of them do with these buy one, get ones, where I pointed this out on the Sprint buy one, get one for the Galaxy S8, where what you actually do is you pay, they're both on 24-month payment plans, both phones. You pay for both phones every single month, and then the trailing month, they rebate you for one of the phone's payment installations. And so the only way to get the second one, quote unquote, free is to actually make all 24 payments and actually wait till the 25th month to get the final installment of the second Galaxy S8 back as a bill credit.
That's so infuriating.
So if you leave a year in and you say, I'm done Sprint, I'm going to Verizon, you know, whatever, grass is always greener, you actually have only gotten half off that second Galaxy S8. So, and the reason why they do that, obviously, is to keep you locked in for that 24 months, but also it gets you normalized to having a higher bill. So now your bill, you're used to it being $150 a month because you have $65 a month just of installment plans, and then it gets debited back later.
What happened to the subsidy, man? Back when the day, you could just buy a phone for $200. Granted, this was back in the day of feature phones.
Right.
Yeah. It is fascinating, Daniel. You're right.
Well, you know what else is fascinating? Thrifter. See what I did there?
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So I just want to say this to anybody listening. We're going to go out. I'm going to be as transparent as possible. Every week from now on, we're going to have at least two ads in the show. They're usually going to be products that we really actually like. That is the first and foremost thing. We generally like the brands that sponsor the show. However, there are going to be at least two sponsored spots in the show. Whoever's hosting, whatever happens, that's going to happen. Now, with that out of the way, we'll try our best to keep them as short as possible. That said, I do want to talk about Thrifter. Okay, you've seen Thrifter on the site. Thrifter is a Mobile Nations property, but they're not directly affiliated with AC. What they do, though, is they find the best deals on the internet anywhere, not just for tech. I think there was something about garden equipment the other day, but I was like, okay, cool.
No, something about shoes yesterday.
The best deals possible. And Thrifter was the first place on the internet that found the good Galaxy S8 BOGO deal. This was the one directly from Samsung. It was affiliated with T-Mobile, but it wouldn't make you go through 25 months of, you know, payments before you got your rebate. This is, you buy the two phones, and the next month you get your money back. That's it. So Thrifter is always working to make sure that you are up to date on the best deals. Now, if you go to thrifter.com, you have a bunch of options. You have a feed. You can go through the feed and find the best deals. You can sort it by category, whatever you want. If you're just into tech deals, that's fine. But what you can also do is you can sign up for their newsletter. And I think that's the best thing, to get their newsletter in your inbox every morning. You are the first person to know what's on sale the moment it goes on sale. And I'm talking to you people who haven't bought a Switch yet because you can't find it anywhere. Thrifter was the company that pointed out that the Switch was available on Amazon for me when I bought it. That was, I spent way too much money. But that's because I love Zelda. But I found out about the Switch deal from Thrifter. Thank you for sponsoring, and check it out, www.thrifter.com. Okay, so let's talk about the OnePlus 5. Now, the OnePlus 5 is coming. We know that, Andrew. This is not, they're not even trying to, like, they're not doing controlled leaks. They're basically just dribbling out actual information.
Winter
they're
is
kind of just, they're OnePlus pulling the LG thing where they just slowly announce things
okay, so
prior to launch.
Andrew, what do we know so far about the OnePlus 5?
All right, so in the last week or so, couple weeks, we've gotten some good bits of information. They just came out and said that it's the OnePlus 5, which is cool. That makes it a lot easier for everybody to follow along. They're also confirming that it has the Snapdragon 835, which is kind of a, you know, no duh, but people like confirmation. They also showed off some color swatches that indicating that there might be up to four different color variants, which is surprising because OnePlus is usually just launched with one color and then brought out a second color later on, and it's usually like limited edition or something like that. So let's see, what were they? The colors were like a red, silver, black, and some kind of like a multicolored thing, which would be very interesting. And they're also talking about the fingerprint sensor remaining on the front because that's kind of a hot topic right now. You know, OnePlus likes to take jabs at other companies. So I think they look at the Galaxy S8 and they say, hey, by the way, the fingerprint sensor is actually going to be usable on the OnePlus 5. We have a lot of speculation about what they're going to do as far as, you know, they're going to bump it up to quad HD display, we think. They're going to keep 6 gigs of RAM, but they're also going to have some crazy Chinese model that it has 8 gigabytes of RAM because, of course, along with 128 gigs of storage. We think they're going to go to dual cameras on the back. We don't actually have any real rumors or leaks or anything about necessarily, you know, is it going to go to this super tall display? Like, we know it's going to be, you know, pretty svelte, but is it going to be like Galaxy S8 tall and skinny? We don't really know about that kind of information yet. I think that's kind of the wrap up of at least what we know right now.
And why is OnePlus skipping the OnePlus 4 name?
4 is an unlucky number in China.
Yeah. That's interesting to me because
and also they kind of already had the 3 and 3T.
That's fair.
So
that's true.
You could technically say that was the 4th. But
I wonder, like, was there a Xiaomi Mi 4? I think there was.
Yes, I believe
so. It's interesting which companies are choosing
Mi 4,
to skip 4 and which aren't. I just think that this is them trying to catch up to Samsung and Apple. I think the sooner they can get
the rest of the numbering
convention, the sooner they can get to 8, the better.
Well, so although they already did a OnePlus X, which was a total failure.
Oh,
so
I love that
they
phone.
Really only have, I just picked it up today. I love it. But anyway, so they really only have between, you know, 5 and 9 at that point. But I think that one story that really quickly that can tell you how much thought goes into these things is the OnePlus 3T. The T simply stands for some other companies put an S at the end to indicate a refresh model. And we wanted to go one further than that. So it's the OnePlus 3T. If that gives you an indication of how much backstory there could really be behind a OnePlus 5.
Like, somebody told you this.
Correct.
Are you kidding me? That's absurd. That is absolutely absurd. I kind of love it for its absurdity, but that is just ridiculous.
So OnePlus is rather, they're brash sometimes, I guess you could say.
Yes.
They have retained some of their brashness.
Yes.
And that's, I would not be surprised if it was simply something as simple as, well, we had the 3 and the 3T and we kind of want to catch up, so here's the OnePlus 5.
No, that is totally cool. Fair. I get it. I just, yeah. So, okay. That puts a lot of things in perspective, I guess. So, the OnePlus 5, I mean it's not going to be a like we've seen renders, and I don't know if any of them look real.
Sure.
They seem like they're thrown together from the OnePlus 3T and just, you know, with a few more, like a rounded corner yes. here, a double camera there.
Yeah. I don't put a ton of, that's why I say we don't really know what it's going to look like, because I don't put a ton of stock in what these early, they're not even renders. They're just kind of mock-ups, yeah, I guess it. You would call them.
But it's pretty safe to say that if it does have a front-facing fingerprint sensor, it is not going to eschew the 16:9 aspect ratio of the 3T, right? It's probably going to maintain that general look. Is that necessarily a bad thing, do you think?
I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, I just got done talking about how great I think the U11 is, despite its, you know, old school, old man 16:9 aspect ratio. I think what they need to do is, if you're going to stick with 16:9, you still have to shrink down those bezels. You can't, I mean, I still panned the U11 a bit for being a little too wide and too tall for the size. And everybody said the same thing about the Pixel XL. And we're talking about a OnePlus 5 that may be about the same size if we're talking about a 5.5-inch display. You still have to try to thin it down if you're going to try to compete with, you know, this new wave of going, you know, thinner, narrower, shorter, you know, right. for the screen size. That doesn't necessarily mean you can't stick with 16:9.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we've seen very slim bezel 16:9 phones like the Huawei Mate 9, which, you know, it practically has no bezel on the sides and only a very, very small bezel on the top. But a 5.5-inch phone that has very slim side bezels and as you know, as small as possible vertical bezels is still a relatively compact device. And the OnePlus 3T is usable in one hand. It may not be extremely comfortable, but neither is the Galaxy S8. So it's all about compromise.
Yeah.
You guys know the Galaxy S8s have been ruining social media.
What do you mean?
Because of the taller aspect ratio, so when you post like a Snapchat or an Instagram story, sometimes it's cut off.
Oh, right. I didn't realize that the...
I don't know if you guys have noticed so that.
So the default viewfinder...
Yeah, you and Michael were talking about that.
Is 18:5:9 on Snapchat?
Yeah, but it's the same on Instagram stories too. So if you put text at the top of the image, it'll get cut off when I'm viewing it on the Pixel, for instance.
Okay, that's kind of dumb.
Because Snapchat won't scale the image.
Yeah.
They zoom to fit.
Yeah.
That's really not image. A good idea. I mean, that's Instagram's fault.
No, it is. But I'm only bringing it up because I know we're talking about like the OnePlus 5 seeming sort of like antiquated in the screen ratio. But I just think like everybody is kind of in, you know, everybody seems fine with 16:9. So as long as those bezels are thin.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. And people were talking about that in the U11 review comments as well, because I had mentioned, you know, this difference in aspect ratios. Mm-hmm. I mean, in using the Galaxy S8, I still have many situations in which I open apps and they have black bars at the top and bottom because they're just not designed to scale to... I mean, it doesn't look horrible because you have an on-screen nav bar that's black and a top bar that's black. But when you look at it, you notice it, and it's, you know, unused real estate, especially on some of these media apps that are really focused on 16:9. We're not necessarily there yet. I think it's more about the form factor than just the aspect ratio. You know, is this OnePlus 5 going to be a generic kind of looking phone like the OnePlus 3T was or 3T were? Or is it going to be, you know, have a little more personality to it?
I like to think of OnePlus as the affordable flagship. So it looks, it's chic. It's got a chic, simplistic design. You want to call it boring? I call it simplistic. And it doesn't cost a crap ton, and you don't have to stay sort of tethered to your carrier to get a discount on it. I mean, you just buy it unlocked. You're just going through OnePlus. Granted, you're not, you know, going through the same like Google channels everybody else, but they've been around for a couple of years. And if you're an Android enthusiast, this is a really great affordable device, affordable relative.
How affordable is it going to be, Andrew?
I speculate that they could go higher than the 3T, ooh, which mostly because people complained a tiny bit right at the start that the OnePlus 3T was, is it 429?
439. And one of the two. 3 was 399.
Right. It was $40 higher already. So they bumped it by 10%. People complained a little bit, but they didn't really mind that much because I think we could all agree that at 439, it still represented a great value.
Oh, yeah.
Being $200+ cheaper than other phones in the flagship realm. I could easily see them tossing another $20-$30 on this and make it $459-$469. That would not surprise me. What would surprise me is if they do that but don't start to add in some of the more fringe features. I mean, I know that the rumor is that they're going to go dual cameras on the back. That would be one of those features that, like, you've got to have it if you're going to start charging more money. Quad HD display is going to be another one of those that, you know, people weren't going to pay any extra money in 2017 to have a 1080p display.
I don't know how much people care about that. Honestly, I look at Huawei's insistence on staying at 1080p.
They love 1080p.
I guess I find the difference between 1080p and QHD so negligible in most situations that I'd rather take the battery gain from that 1080p screen any day.
Oh, sure. I mean, look, the Galaxy S8 and S8 Plus are set to 1080p, well, you know, plus the little bump on top by default. And I totally understand OnePlus sticking with 1080p previously from a performance standpoint, battery standpoint. Like, they were able to get ridiculous battery life and good performance out of it. But the spec junkie type people that are buying the OnePlus 3 or the OnePlus 5 because, you know, people were going crazy over the fact that confirming that it has an 835 in it and they have to have 6 or 8 gigs of RAM, you know, those are the type of people that are also looking for quad HD display. And those are the little extra things I just think that OnePlus has to put in there if they're going to increase the price. But hey, I mean, maybe they stick with 439. I think that would be fine as well. But they're going to have to keep up by, you know, adding some extra stuff.
What about wireless payments? Are we going to have that in the OnePlus 5?
they brought it back on the... was it the 3 that they brought it back on, Daniel?
And
bringing NFC back? Yeah.
Yeah,
because so it was have just it the OnePlus 2
that didn't have NFC.
Ah, and okay. Sorry, y'all. And I missed OnePlus, that one.
Did the OnePlus X have it?
No, but
no, it did
that
not.
Didn't even, yeah, barely had like a screen that just,
that phone didn't exist. Hey, that thing's beautiful and I love it.
But. I thought it was amazing. I thought that, so I mean, we kind of know the inside scoop around why that didn't get any updates, and it was mainly to do with Qualcomm than anything else. You know, I think the Qualcomm just stopped supporting the Snapdragon 801.
Oh, 801, man, what a relic
R-I-P.
That thing was.
R.I.P.
Well, it was crazy to think that, we'll just have a podcast about the OnePlus X now, if you don't mind. But it was crazy to think that the OnePlus X was like end of life, not even a year after it came out.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting with OnePlus, right? It's in the same situation with the OnePlus 2, where it's barely a two-year-old phone, and people are complaining that there's no roadmap for a Nougat update. OnePlus has done so well supporting the OnePlus 3 and 3T, and looks like it's going to continue doing that for months and maybe even a year from now. And yet the OnePlus 2 on the Snapdragon 810 is languishing. And I think, right, based on what I understand about the 810 as well, is that it was also partially Qualcomm's fault. If you look at the number of phones that were updated to Nougat on the 810, it's basically, you can count it on one hand. It's the HTC One M9, the Nexus 6P, and a couple of other phones, but you won't find Nougat on many phones running the Snapdragon 810. So I don't know if it's as much OnePlus's fault as as they claim it is. I'm not trying to defend them. I still think they should, because, you know, let's face it, it's a small company with a very loyal user base, and people are fickle and they will throw you away for any reason. But I do think it is partially Qualcomm to blame.
That was beautifully nihilistic, by the way.
Thank you.
The issue with, well, it's not an issue necessarily, but the situation with OnePlus's user base, or, you know, fan base, is at on one end of the spectrum, they have a lot of people that upgrade often. They had a lot of people that upgraded from the 3 to the 3T. And, you know, they had people that upgraded, you know, from the 2 to the 3T, from the 2 to 3. Like, they aren't the kind of people that hold on to a phone for 2 years. But at the same time, the people that do are the ones that are expecting every single update to their OnePlus 2. And like Daniel said, like, not that many phones got updated, but people are still, you know, with that chipset, but people are still expecting them, because that's not that old of a phone. Especially when they're talking about a Nougat update, you know, 6 months ago, that really wasn't an old phone. It wasn't even 18 months old at that point. So it's a tough market for OnePlus to be in, because they have to, you know, they have to satiate both sides of it.
Yeah, I missed a couple of phones that were updated. The Motorola Droid Turbo 2 received Nougat, I believe.
Jeez, forgot that phone existed.
The G Flex 2 never did, right?
I forgot that existed.
the Xperia Z5 line all run on the A10, and I do believe those were updated, if I'm not mistaken. But I think that was market by market, because the Canadian version never received Nougat.
Right.
Anyway, all that's to say, I think Qualcomm is aware of the issue. The custom, you know, basically the A10 was just a Cortex A57, Cortex A53 white label template from ARM that they just turned into something to get a 64-bit chip out as soon as possible. Whereas the A20 and now the A35 are much more custom. The whole manufacturing process has been aligned with the software and the drivers. And from what I understand, Qualcomm is in a much better position to keep newer phones updated. And that also speaks to, like, last week we talked about Treble and how Treble was something that was announced before I/O, and it was one of those more understated or under the radar announcements. But Treble is basically what this will prevent in the future. It is going to prevent a Snapdragon A10 like situation from happening, because Qualcomm will be required to pass a bunch of tests to make sure that its chips are going to be upgradable to a new version of Android.
Yes.
So
it'll basically extend the runway for those devices a while longer. You know, there will be at some point chip limitations, but this just means that, you know, there's no real reason why a OnePlus X or a OnePlus 2 can't run Nougat perfectly, other than this deep level hardware support. So Treble would enable that update to go through.
And OnePlus also consolidated its two software development teams this year or last year. It's done a lot to improve the way that it rolls out betas. So they have an open beta program, they have a closed beta program. So there are three separate tracks for software updates. So there's always something happening. So that is all to say, you can't really, you know, you can't begrudge them if you're a OnePlus 3 or 3T owner. But what you may be begrudging is not being able to buy a OnePlus 3T anymore, because the company actually came out and said that the 3T is being discontinued, which is interesting, right? Because
wasn't it special edition matte black? Get it while you can.
That sold out. That was completely separate. That, they had a limited run of that. I'm talking about the 3T itself, except for India. After stock runs out of the 3T, you will not be able to buy it. Andrew, what do you think's up with that? Why don't they just sell it at $100 discount?
They're basically, well, the first thing they're saying is the OnePlus 5 is going to be here sooner than we think. If they're going to just literally say, you know, while stock lasts, I would say that they obviously looked at their numbers and said it's costing us, you know, a decent amount of money to continually stock these devices.
Oh, yeah,
and we
point.
Think that, like I said earlier, we have such an upgrade rate where people move on and don't care about the last gen model enough that we're better off just making OnePlus 5s. I agree that I think a OnePlus 3T at $329 or $339 would be really great to keep around because it's still relevant. I mean, even if you just sell it for the next 6 months, sell it through the end of the year would be really good. But there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of overhead involved with keeping, you know, continually producing more of these phones. It's not like they have warehouses full of 3Ts and, you know, they're just going to be, you know, packing them into trucks and, you know, driving them into, you know, a mountain to seal and never look at them again. I think they're
that's
actually
some James
just straight
Bond
up
bad guys stuff right there.
I think they've just straight up run, you know, they've run to the point where, okay, we can decide to, you know, there are minimum runs that you have to make of these phones. You know, we can decide to make another 10,000 or 50,000 OnePlus 3Ts, or we can stop. And they're, you know, they're at the end of this cycle of a run and they say, well, we had a pretty good, you know, pretty good run of these. We sold however many million and we're going to focus on the OnePlus 5. I mean, OnePlus just seems like a company that's not particularly interested in keeping that legacy around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess so. The cynic in me says that it also makes it easier to justify the end of support for its older phones when you no longer sell them.
The sooner you stop selling it, you start that countdown clock where you could no longer support it. Yeah. I mean, so they're stopping sales less than a year after the OnePlus 3 came out. And the 3T came out, you know, 4 months after that.
You couldn't buy the 3 after you bought the 3T, right? Or after this 3T
went on sale. It replaced it, yeah.
I mean, imagine that.
But that was understandable, though.
But imagine Samsung only selling one phone. I mean, even Apple sells like 7 different SKUs of the iPhone these days.
But thus is the reminder that OnePlus is still just a startup.
Oh, yeah. I'm absolutely. But I'm just saying from a marketing perspective, like yeah. In Canada, we have this, I don't know if you've heard of this beer called Steam Whistle. It's like a very middle of the road lager. It's like very easy drinking, but the whole marketing campaign around this beer is that they do one thing really well, that they don't make any other beer in their facility. They don't try to mess up the recipe. It's just this one thing that's done the same way every single time. And it's been a massive success because it's reliable. And I think there is an element of that here with OnePlus where you really do have a company that is focused entirely on one flagship thing and then the ecosystem around it. So the accessories, the contests, the marketing, all that stuff, that all kind of sits around the perimeter, which I think is super interesting.
I mean, really just think about all of the extra stuff that you have to do. As soon as you widen your lineup of devices, now you have to presumably continue to sell accessories for the OnePlus 3T. You have to continue to have support lines for that much longer. Above and beyond just the channel staying open to sell the devices, OnePlus is very, you know, a small ecosystem. They don't have a long run of third-party accessory makers making things for them, and you know they would have to keep all of these, you know, repair facilities available and all this kind of stuff that they just don't seem that interested in. And I think bringing it back to the OnePlus X, because we just continue to talk about this phone forever as mine reboots after installing an update, is that they tried this. Instead of keeping an old phone around, they said, we're going to release a new low-end phone. I think was this $199 or something like that?
Yes, it was. No, it was $249. And then $249. Yeah, and then it was dumped down to
$199. So at $249, they said, you know, we're going to have this phone that's a considerable notch lower, and it's just we're going to release a new low-end phone rather than keeping an old model around. And aside from all of the other issues, that just didn't work for them. Nobody wanted it because they already represented a really good value in their own OnePlus 5. And so it would kind of take away from the OnePlus 5's value if they continued to sell the 3T, you know, at what would have to be a discounted price at that point. So I guess I understand it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's summertime, so it's OnePlus time. I mean, it's their time to shine at the one thing they make the best.
You know what's interesting, though? Like, with something like the OnePlus, it's sort of like television, where we got used to for a few years only seeing big releases right after Mobile World Congress and around IFA or closer to the fall. And now we have a steady stream of phones coming out around early June. And I like it. I mean, we get there's no more seasons of phone releases. It's like, it's just an annual thing. It's awesome.
Yeah, we're going to go from the G6 in March mm-hmm. all the way to OnePlus 5 in, you know, presumably late June, early July. Like, that's in multiple phones in between.
Yeah.
And one of those multiple phones is from Dan, take it away. That was my attempt at a transition.
That was good. I enjoyed that.
There are other companies making phones, turns out.
Well, if you're talking about Motorola, there's no phones. There's just a story.
Well-written story.
Oh, thanks. So yeah, I went to New York this week to talk to Motorola's executive team, because they're really looking for they're looking to tell the story of why they're using Motorola again, as opposed to last year, where it seemed like Motorola was fading out.
Motorola by Lenovo.
It was going to be Lenovo Moto X or Lenovo Moto Z or something. And for a while, we weren't really sure. Were they investing in the Lenovo name and trying to phase out Motorola as a brand? Or were they, you know, just going to call things like the Moto X, like the Madonna of phones? Like there would be no company associated with it at all, except for on the box. And what they told us was that they had a lot of different opinions, and they went back and forth around what was the best thing. And then they hired this new chief marketing officer in the middle of last year called, with the best name. His name is Jan Hochfeld. He's awesome. German of German origin, but I believe lives in Chicago, where Motorola's headquarters are. And he is a super interesting guy, like very no BS. He's like, we recognized a little bit too late after Lenovo bought Motorola back in 2014 that Motorola is one of the most recognizable brands in the world. He actually said that in the technology industry, Motorola is more recognizable than Samsung. Recognizable than LG. Mm-hmm. You know Motorola. You may not have used one of their phones for many years, but you know Motorola. So they're bringing it back. They're bringing back the Motorola name on all of their phones. In fact, they're phasing out Lenovo in every single country except for India. And I'm talking about phones, not laptops or tablets. Just the Lenovo name will not be on any phones released by the company. They're bringing back the Batwing in a big way. And you saw this. I mean, this isn't particularly new, because the Batwing was there, you know, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And they're bringing back Hello Moto. And you've seen that in every single commercial they've released. But
Hello Moto. More
than that, they want to tell a story about, you know, why Motorola is this very valuable thing to them, that nostalgia is not just about bringing back the past, but about, you know, trying to repurpose it for the present and the future. And there was a whole lot of marketing shtick that I wasn't super into. But the takeaway here was that the Moto G 5 and the Moto Z have been their best launches by sales in their history of smartphones.
Really?
Like, I'm not talking about like the Moto Razr from 2006.
No, yeah, in smartphones, really?
But they're the Moto Z is selling better than any Moto X before it, even under Google. And
I mean, for as much as we love the Moto X, that thing did not sell.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a high bar. So that's true.
Yeah, of course.
But the one stat that was super interesting was that the Moto G5 in Latin America sold more. It's sold more to date than all Moto G lines combined.
Oh my gosh.
Which is crazy because the Moto G was the most successful phone that Motorola has ever launched. And it's got a 22% market share in Brazil, which is its biggest its biggest market. So if you think about
Brazil, loves those motos.
It's doing gangbusters. So yeah, I mean that's the big takeaway here is that Motorola is back. They're really trying to unify a lot of things, and you know we've seen rumors of their release schedule for 2017.
Yeah.
And if that's true, every phone is basically going to look the same. There's going to be a $700 Moto Z that's going to look the same as a 100 euro Moto C. And to me, that's interesting because that's exactly what Samsung has done. You know, a Galaxy A or a Galaxy J doesn't use the same high-end components, but it looks exactly the same.
That's really true. Oh man, that's smart. I like that idea. That's how I like to shop for phones. You know, for me, I get the flagship nice one, and maybe for my parent or cousin, I get them, you know, something a little cheaper, and we all have matching phones. I mean, just kidding.
That's adorable,
but you know, well, in all actuality,
it grows the brand exactly. recognition super well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Jan used the word aspirational a lot. He's like, we want Motorola to be an aspirational brand, like it was back when the Razr was the most popular phone in the world, and they're doing a lot to make that case. By basically doing the opposite of what every other phone company is doing. You know, every company's going really minimal, soft piano music in their commercials. Apple's the biggest, Apple's the most guilty of this, right?
They'll tug at your heartstrings in their ads, man.
Right, and, like everything is fully emotional. Too.
Oh my God, Microsoft is getting there. I'm finding myself crying more and more at these commercials, by the way. Just getting too
well, it's working, I guess. But you'll never cry at a Moto commercial because Moto is going, it's going like industrial, very loud, very electronic, very, very...
Oh, it's going millennial.
It's a little bit, yeah. I mean, it's going kind of heartless, but in a very controlled way. Like, it doesn't necessarily want to appeal to your emotion. It wants to appeal to your adrenaline. And that, I think, is working because the brand recognition around Moto Mods and the Moto Z line has actually been it's overrepresented in terms of sales. So the Moto Z line has only sold a couple million units, but a lot of people know what a Moto Z product is, and they know what a Moto Mod is if you were to ask them. And they showed us some stats that were really shocking to me because from my perspective, the Moto Z line has not been a huge success.
Yes.
I love it, but it hasn't been a huge success. Yeah.
That's why I'm super surprised because like I see the billboards here, right? Because it's the Verizon phone that they really try to hawk besides the Pixel. But when I ask any friend about Moto, they go, they still make phones? I haven't thought about them since the Razr. Which, you know, that. So that's why I'm like super blown away that this has actually been a relative success.
Yeah. I mean, they seem like they have their head on their shoulders. So, you know, hopefully there'll be some new products in the next little while and down the road.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? It'll be an interesting year for Motorola. And I'm super happy that they're using that name again because nobody really cares about Lenovo as a phone company. They especially in North America, they have absolutely zero impact. So,
I mean, they have minimal brand awareness in the US outside of the enterprise as well.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
Exactly. That was another part of the presentation. This is sort of an aside, but they're really doubling down on yoga. Like yoga is apparently incredibly well respected and recognizable brand from on the tablet and mm-hmm. Laptop side, the two-in-ones. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, we'll see a lot more yoga stuff too. He didn't mention anything about Android, but there is a yoga.
Yoga foam confirms. I see what you did there.
Yep, that was me. Gave it all away. Sorry. Lenovo Motorola.
It does 235 poses. Pose it any way you like. It has removable clothing and you can swap its outfits.
Ah, this is getting pornographic flow.
No, it's supposed to be a doll. Come on.
NSFW.
It's supposed to be like a Barbie doll.
All right, well, let's wrap it up. We covered a lot of ground today. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we head off into the great unknown?
I want to get my hands on one of those HTC U11s, man. I think that thing is kind of the direction that I wish the Pixel would go. I would love to see the... Oh, man. Oh, that would be it. It's the Pixel.
It's good-looking phone.
Yeah, with that kind of, like, paint on the back. Just, you know, this really... cool element about it. I just really love the U11 and the way it looks, and I think other smartphone manufacturers, y'all should take note. That's how to make a pretty phone.
Well, that's a good thing to wish for. We'll know what the Pixel 2 looks like in a few months, but I think I'll have to let you down easy, Flo, because there's no chance the Pixel 2 will look like that.
I know, but I can dream.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here. Andrew, where can people find you if they want to learn more about what you do and where you're from?
Find me on the Twitter at Andrew Martinik, MARTONIK, and go read my U11 review. It's actually, and watch the video inside. Alex did a great job on the video review as well.
Yeah, Alex is in Taipei for Computex.
So. He did this review video on a series of planes. Somewhere between the UK and
he did it in the air.
Yep.
Well, Florence Ion, where can people find you?
Well, I'm all over the Snapchat and Twitters at OhThatFlow. That's where you can find me. And of course, on AndroidCentral.com. And this week, we had the Samsung DeX review. So if you're curious if that's something that could replace your laptop life, well, spoiler alert, it's not. But go read why.
I do want to know why. But I read your review, so now I know why.
Yes.
Well, my name is Daniel Bader. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will be back with another episode next week. I will be gone. I'm taking a much-needed break.
Yay!
But Andrew will be in charge of all the things, so be nice. Thanks for tuning in.
It'll be good.
We'll see you then.
Ciao.
Bye.